Tonight marks the last of a series of broadcasts conducted by Father Coughlin. Until next October, he will not appear again before the microphone with his weekly talks. However, he will not relinquish the Children's Hour, which is broadcast every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Meanwhile, the weekly newspaper, Social Justice, will carry Father Coughlin's regular messages between now and October. The progress of labor, the national debate on the Supreme Court issue, and other current topics of vital interest will be covered by Father Coughlin's pen during his temporary retirement from the air. You can obtain this paper by writing this week or next week to Father Coughlin. Tonight, Father Coughlin will discuss for you the subject of relief which failed to relieve. And now, Father Coughlin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Many times it has been pondered by persons just why a Catholic priest has deigned to discuss such mundane topics as politics, economics, money, prices, labor, and strikes. There is a reason, a very vital reason. Christianity, as you know, has its very definite doctrine and dogma on the subject of justice. Christianity teaches, in the words of Pius XI, that it is well nigh impossible for an individual who has been unjustly exploited, who has been unjustly denied the conveniences and necessities of this life, to practice the moral virtues. Hence, Christianity has openly and consistently inveighed against the exploitation of the poor, the concentration of wealth, the underpayment of labor, and the usury in the money markets. Were Christianity to be silent, she would be a coward. Were she to be a compromiser, she would be no better, perchance, than those who say peace, peace, when there is no peace, watching her subjects going into desolation and into the valley of destruction. Consequently, it has become the burden of a Catholic priest, in this instance and in many other instances, perhaps to speak of subjects upon which Christian pulpits too long have been silent. She speaks of them not because she is primarily interested in the things we eat, or in the clothing we wear, or in the houses in which we are sheltered. She speaks of those things because without her philosophy finding root, finding maturity, and finding practice in the minds and daily lives of American citizens, woe to Christianity. Sometimes with a tear in our eye, we look askance upon Mexico. We look downheartedly upon Spain. We bow our heads to what has been actuated in Germany. And we strike our breasts with a mea culpa because we have watched melt into almost nothingness the once grand power of Russia. Russia, 1917. For the avalanche of socialistic filth came forth to overrun the capitals of the earth and to infiltrate the minds of individuals with unsafe, unsound, and illogical ways out of the depression which came upon the world to blight its progress. Consequently, we do dare speak of politics when politics assail religion and its principles. We do dare speak of labor and wages and capital and money and taxation when those things have been so mistreated by men in power politically, men in power industrially, and men in power financially, as to make a wreckage of this a once prosperous nation. Some thoughts I would leave in your mind as I take my recess tonight until next October. The thoughts are these. The Christian church has a very definite philosophy which underlies the science of political science or political economy. For example, on the subject of ownership, it is our doctrine that Almighty God, in creating man for the sole singular purpose of enjoying heaven for all eternity after having passed through this Sahara of life, Almighty God, in creating man to live upon this earth, likewise created the fields and the forests, the mines, and every other function through which man can live. Those things are necessary for human life. Those things are necessary for human sustenance. But in the creating of them, God Almighty did not relinquish ownership of either lands or forests, of either human intellects or human wills. God is the sole, omnipotent, and regal owner of all things on this earth. And they have been created in turn to be creatures and servants to men. Our philosophy, therefore, relying upon the scriptural phrase which says that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, comes down through logical sequence to the very intimate relations of our daily lives. Confronted, therefore, with Christian philosophy, we ask ourselves, is it moral, is it righteous for a few men or a group of men to so control industry that the vast mass of laborers in this nation are forced to work at the will of the industrialist who lays claim to private propertyship and unfurls that flag against the other rights which men in common prefer to uphold? Private propertyship, oh yes. Christianity does uphold that theory. It does not go to the opposite extreme, loved by the socialist or the communist. It does not uphold the heresy of collectivism. But private propertyship, as Christianity interprets it, means this and only this, that while man through his energy and ability wins some small portion of earth as his own, while man raises aloft and unfurls the flag of ownership over that portion of earth, he dare not mingle the idea that ownership and use are identical. A man may own a stream, the only freshwater stream in his county, perchance. Because he owns it, he dare not say to his neighbors, "Thou shalt not drink here," when dire necessity or when ordinary circumstances force individuals to use what belongs to others. That, may chance, is a case somewhat exaggerated. Does not fit in, perchance, with modern events. But nevertheless, it serves to explain the differentiation between ownership and use. A differentiation in our modern times that has been discarded by capitalism as we know it. Again, Christianity has a very definite theory relative to private ownership. While it upholds that doctrine of private ownership, it also upholds and defends the thesis that some things by their nature are too important, too valuable, and too essential for the whole human race or for a nation that private individuals own or control them. I may cite the example of sunshine, of water, of fresh air. I can further cite the example which was in the mind of the founding fathers of this nation when they inscribed their names beneath the Constitution of the United States
the Constitution that says Congress has the power to coin and regulate the value of money. Oh, do not smile as I say this. I ask you, farmers, why is it that you are unable to till your ground, raise your wheat, sell it at the market for a profit? Because there's no money extant or available. I ask you, laborers, why is it that you are always growling for higher wages? Why is it that sometimes you are forced to sit in idleness in the ranks of those who have no jobs, simply because there is no money in the pockets of the industrialist to hire you? I ask you, industrialist, why it is that at seasons you are forced to close your factories, that your belts of production are slackened, that your machinery becomes idle because the purchasing power, the money available in the pockets of the consumers of the nation is not there. Why is it that boats rust at docks in the ports? Why is it that their holds are empty of wheat, of cotton, of corn, and of products? Because there is no money, money for which trade can be implemented, money by which these things can be obtained by others. In other words, the common denominator of all business, industry, farming, labor, and commerce is that vital thing called money, the vehicle, the medium of exchange. And yet, despite the fact that Christianity has complained bitterly in the encyclical letters of Pius XI that a group of individuals have so gained control of issuing and regulating money that the rest of us dare not breathe against their will, despite the fact that the Congress of the United States has specifically said that Congress or the people should issue and regulate the money, we Americans stand like dolts stupefied today after a four-year period of relief, a four-year period of New Deal, a four-year period of Reconstruction, worse off at this moment than when Herbert Hoover left the White House in 1933. You question that statement? Dare not question it, because I will use for you the latest government facts. Relief that does not relieve. Relief? Oh, yes, turn back the page to 1929, to 1933, when our streets were filled with the unemployed, when our farms were vacated, when property was being confiscated, and when little children and innocent women were living on the belt of starvation. I again repeat, in many senses, we are worse off at that moment. What are the facts? Well, according to Mr. Green, the president of the American Federation of Labor, there are 9 million unemployed American citizens at this moment. Do not take his figures. Take the figures of Harry Hopkins, the administrator of the WPA, and he admits that probably we have 7.5 million unemployed at this moment, and they are conservative figures. And more than that, 7.5 million unemployed, where are the employed persons working today? At present, there are 3 million jobless on the federal relief payrolls, another 1,500,000 on the pay relief rolls of the states, counties, towns, and hamlets of America, 4.5 to 4.75 million jobless managing to live without relief, and these are figures which your New Deal government admits. There's where we get our 8 million unemployed. Or else look at it from another standpoint. Counting all the families of American citizens, there are together 25 million men, women, and children in this nation after 4 years of the New Deal who are forced to eat the black bread of relief. Relief? Why, those figures surpass the figures which Herbert Hoover bequeathed to this nation in 1933. Relief? Relief that has failed to relieve. Although the federal government in these 4 years has spent $10 billion to correct unemployment, and although counties, states, towns, and hamlets have spent $3 billion on the same project, $13 billion over 4 years, $3.5 billion every year to break the back of unemployment, to relieve a situation that grew out of the sins of modern capitalism, and as a result of it all, we have accumulated more upon relief. We have accumulated approximately $50 billion of debts of money poured down the rat hole of civilization, and we have inherited a laziness and a laxity and a system of living off Uncle Sam on the part of one-fifth of our nation. God knows if we will ever break that immorality down in the minds of those of us who have some sanity left. Really, that does not relieve. Has this federal government, during its 4 years of New Deal, once asked itself, what is the cause of this unemployment? Has this federal government once asked itself, what is the cause of want in the midst of plenty? Oh, no, it has assiduously avoided answering these questions and asking these questions because it would be forced to go back to March 3rd, 1933 and find out today what it knew then. I still hear reverberating from the steps of the Citadel in Washington those glorious golden words of driving the money changers from the temple. Somehow or other, they seem more golden now. They seem as if they were born in the fairyland of hope. They seem as if they were born only to haunt us, who knew what the real cause was. A cause of permitting privateers to manufacture money, dollar bills, the same as it permits Henry Ford to manufacture motor cars. If the rest of us were sagacious under that system, we'd throw away our dinner buckets, close up our factories, and all seek franchise from the government to buy printing presses and begin coining and regulating our money. All these things are not the issuance of a crackpot. 2 years ago and 1 year ago, nay, last October and November, America knew the answer to this puzzle, and America still continued to proceed with the problem of relief through borrowing other people's money to keep the old one-horse shay from breaking down entirely. And today the one-horse shay of modern capitalism is ambling its way through Washington, is spreading its tracks through every state in the Union as it creaks its way along, squeaking and squawking of the destruction that is imminent before us. The one-horse shay that 10,000 new dealers with their false philosophy can never save because it's doomed to destruction. My friends, these thoughts are not born as vagaries in the mind of one who stands before you simply to express disillusionment. They are born in the minds of one who could this moment, if he had chosen, have ridden on that one-horse shay with the best of them. They rise in the minds of one who could have been a yes man 3 and 4 years ago had he chosen. But this yes man has nothing to gain, nothing to lose. He has simply his God to fear, his people to love, and his principles to defend. And therefore, choosing right instead of might. Choosing to be on the side of justice instead of on the side of modern capitalism with its intermingling with socialism and communism, I stand before you tonight to warn you, careless of what the future holds for me, that this relief that has failed to relieve by pounding up its taxation, by doubling its assessment upon the payrolls of the nation, by finding its way into the grocer shops where you purchase your food, this relief that lives upon a sucker's taking from the people every penny they own, is due to crumble and fall before 1 year from this April. You think you know what depression is? You people living on the WPA envelopes. WPA envelopes filled partly from the money confiscated from industry and commerce and from the envelopes of those who are working. How long can that last? It can't last forever. There's no bottomless pit to that spending. You WPA workers and those of you who are living upon the dole system, how long can it last for this Federal Reserve Bank to invent and coin and issue its own bogus money against the debts of a nation? And then when the bond market drops as it's dropping now, print more fresh $5 bills to buy in its own bonds. Oh, there's a law of compensation, and there's an accounting to be held, an accounting that shall make the depression of 1929 seem as a prosperity when it breaks upon you. What sins we have committed. When the Bill of Rights was established in England, it insisted that the spending power be held in the hands of the people. It insisted that the spending power of a nation be held in the hands of its parliament or its Congress. View the New Deal in 1933 and 34. Did it revere the Bill of Rights for which men had bled and died? Oh, no. It took the Bill of Rights as it's taking our Constitution today and tore it into shreds and handed over the spending power from the purse of the people, from the purse of Congress, to the President of the United States. One step backwards, one step towards dictatorship. That may seem peculiar to you, but in doing that, Congress relinquished its own liberty and relinquished its own freedom of speech. Since that day, since the chief executive of the nation has the full spending power of billions of dollars, Congress must bend its pregnant knee before him. Congress must become a rubber stamp Congress or else be rubbed out of existence in the line of patronage. All patronage, all partyism, save us from those things. We who once loved patriotism, we who once loved democracy, we who once proudly raised our heads, favoring justice with a heel upon us, ready to spawn and crush every injustice. I tell you those things on this last time that I shall have the privilege of broadcasting to you before next October. I tell you them fearlessly, simply because out of the 60 million employable American citizens living in our nation at the moment, there are no more jobs for them under 45 million. 15 million persons must be unemployed. Under the New Deal philosophy, 15 million persons must go through life with a tin cup of the dole in their hands, seeking relief from those who have jobs. And all so unnecessary. Yesterday, or the day before yesterday to be more exact, there was a conference in Washington of the cabinet members seeking to cut down the expenditure for dole. What a dilemma for the master politician of all times. cut down his dolls, and he leads his following, leads them into disruption and into rebellion. Cut down his dolls to balance his budget, and he leads to posterity, to the little children gathered in your home, an unbearable debt which they must pay as we have boondoggled our way through 4 years of relief that failed to relieve. Where are we sagacious and where are we intelligent? We would have spent money in 1933 on the immediate necessities of relief. We would have been glad to feed those unfortunates, to clothe the naked, and to build homes for the shelterless. But immediately, the first $1 billion that we had over and above that first necessity, we would have expended it upon analyzing the problem of why there is unemployment, why there is want in the midst of plenty. Two problems that have been assiduously avoided by this administration after $3,500,000,000 has been expended annually in 34, 35, 36, and in 37 to keep up an impossible situation of relieving the sins of modern capitalism and protecting the very evils which have brought us to our knees at this moment. Ladies and gentlemen, I have weighed well every word which I've spoken to you. I am in deadly earnest, and by no means do I intend to retreat from this fight of driving the money changers from the temple. In no way do I decide tonight or any other time to show a lily-livered flag before those who hold power. They may hold power over politicians, but they hold no power over a pulpit of a Catholic church that dares preach for the alleviation of misery, that dares inveigh against usury, and that dares clamors for an honest living annual wage free from the sins of the past and free from the excesses of the future. God be with you. God be with all of us in this fight that shall last until death comes, if necessary, rather than till surrender bids us put up a white flag. Good night and God bless you.
Until next October, you may follow his comments on the Supreme Court, on labor, and on all other vital issues of the day by writing to him and asking him to mail you a regular copy of his weekly news magazine, Social Justice. This broadcast originated from the Shrine of the Little Flower at Royal Oak, Michigan, and reached you over a special network.